Thank you for coming. I recognize some of my students. I'll try not to repeat anything that I've done in my classes, but you will be more familiar. You have a bit of an advantage over the rest of the audience if you've been in my class so far. So the title of the talk is Aid Politics and the New World Order. So, I mean, the New World Order is this phrase that was coined by George Bush Sr. in 1991, and it was a statement of the U.S. being the sole determiner of the international order from that point on. But who... So that was the statement, the question of who shapes the world order. Bush's answer was the United States. That's what the world order means. But today, I think, and in fact it seems like a theme of all of the lectures in this series that Professor Alam has put together, is that we're moving away from that single hegemon world, moving away from a unipolar situation into a situation that's multipolar, into a situation where, especially in particular parts of the world, you have regional powers that are rising. So in this part of the world, India is becoming a major player. India is becoming a regional power and possibly, potentially a world power. So we can ask, as a lot of you are young political science students, as students of international politics, we can ask, what kind of power is India going to be? What kind of world order is going to emerge from these powers? What kind of choices will they make? So there's the end of the Cold War, there's this unipolar world. Let's go back. The end of World War II. That was the emergence of the previous order, okay? And in nominally, the post-World War II order was a liberal one. The idea was that there was this United Nations Charter, and there was the idea that the United Nations would consist of nations that were sovereign, but that were bound by a framework of international law to protect universal rights. And there was an idea that these sovereign states would eventually be moving towards democracy. So sovereignty was valued, democracy was valued, human rights were valued. This was all written into these United Nations documents. The idea was we should have an international legal framework in order to prevent events like World War II, where international aggression was the norm, and so on. That was what was written into the documents, but of course, that's as political scientists, we know we could talk about that as a liberal order or a idealist kind of way of looking at things. Then there's the more realist idea, which is that the world order isn't shaped by pretty statements and documents, it's shaped by power and interest. And so who are the actual power, who are the powerful countries in the world order, who are the powerful economic interests, right? This is something that political science doesn't grapple with as well as it should, is the role of economic interests, political economy, and class interests. So in fact, there's already a difference in the old world order between what was stated as the governing principles and the actual realities of economic interest and political and military power in the world. So in realist terms, there was the Cold War. There was a Soviet bloc, there was a Western bloc. India was part of a non-aligned bloc. India was part of what was called the Third World. And so in a way, because of this contradiction, you might come to the conclusion that the real world order is this crude world of power and control, and the liberal framework of sovereign states and international law is just some kind of cover story. But I don't think that's entirely true. I think that in politics, in any kind of political struggle, legitimacy matters. So if you think of, there's a theorist of revolution that I really like. He's from this part of the world, Iqbal Ahmed. He was from Pakistan, but he taught in the United States. He died in 1999, but he talked about a lot about political struggle, about guerrilla movements, about social movements, and he said that guerrilla movements all need to understand that armed struggle is political struggle, and that political struggle is a struggle for legitimacy. And so no matter what kind of fight, no matter what kind of conflict you're talking about, you cannot neglect legitimacy. Nobody can afford to neglect the question of legitimacy. Even the most powerful, the most militarily powerful hegemon in the world has to attend to this question of legitimacy. This is something that Gramsci also talked about. The whole concept of hegemony is based on this idea that hegemony means people adopt your assumptions, people think thoughts according to your framework, which gives you that level of control, which is almost beyond or above any kind of questioning, precisely because you've controlled the framework with which people used to think. So legitimacy matters. And aid politics, I think, is principally about legitimacy. Aid politics, and it has always been throughout these different phases. So in the Cold War, aid was heavily, heavily political. So the Soviet bloc and the Chinese, they gave aid according to their priorities of trying to further and enlarge the bloc of countries that were socialist. And the West gave aid in order to prevent that. So there was a contest. And as a third world country, as a poor country looking for aid, it was, I don't want to use a term like this, but it was almost something like a market. There was a competition. You could go shopping and see who was offering you the better package. It wasn't quite like this because geographically, if you're in the Western Hemisphere, you're awfully close to the United States, and if you're in Eastern Europe, you're awfully close to the Soviet Union. So there were other considerations, but when there were multiple powers, multiple poles in the world, there was this kind of potential for competition in aid. And President Kennedy of the United States, he was quite explicit about the importance of aid and the USAID program and a number of other programs. And there's this quote from Kennedy that's very famous where he said, "Those who make peaceful change impossible make violent change inevitable." So he was basically saying, unless we provide material aid to these countries that are poor, we will end up encouraging them to join revolution and socialism and independent nationalism and so on. So Cold War politics was about this struggle for legitimacy. The West was trying to say, if you join our side, we will provide you with all of these privileges, development, not just through the free market, but also explicitly through aid. What happened at the end of the Cold War with the defeat of the Soviet Union, or the collapse of the Soviet Union, was the options for poor countries were reduced. If you don't like what the West is offering now, you can take it or leave it, but you don't really have anywhere else to go. So this was this was a factor, and an important factor in determining the future and the economic fate of the very poorest countries in the world. And that's what I'm going to focus on in these three examples that I'm going to try to get through if I have time. 3 or 4 minutes each. So the very poorest countries in the world. So there's a development economist, very mainstream, named Paul Collier, C-O-L-L-I-E-R, and he has this book called The Bottom Billion. So he's talking about development economics today, where he says the majority of the world is no longer, there's hope, like the majorities in the world have hope for economic advancement, but one huge chunk of the global population, about 1 billion people, at the bottom of the economic pyramid, they don't have a lot of hope for advancement, they don't have a lot of opportunity ahead of them, and it's from a developmental perspective, from an aid politics perspective, it's the bottom billion that we need to focus on. And so Collier has a series of analyses about why the bottom billion stays the bottom billion. They get into these traps like resource conflicts and so on. It's interesting. I don't agree entirely with the whole analysis, but the point is there's this persistent set of countries and economies that are finding it almost impossible to get out of this situation of absolute economic misery. And that is a stain on the legitimacy of any world order, especially one that says, the Western world order that says, you know, the mythology of the West is if you work hard and if you participate in the free market and are competitive, then you will be able to then you'll be able to prosper. So that mythology falls apart if a huge portion of the population is perpetually trapped in poverty. And those are the countries today that are not only not being helped by aid politics, but they are, I'm arguing, actually being maintained in their situation partly through the particular politics of aid and their lack of alternatives, their lack of options in the world today, their lack of political options. So the first case that I want to talk about is Haiti. I wrote a book about Haiti. It's called Haiti's New Dictatorship. My class has already heard a lot about Haiti, but the fundamental issue in Haiti today is you had an elected government in 2004. 2004 is now 15 years into unipolar world order. In 2004, this elected government was trying to do various sort of independent developmental things. They were trying to build schools, they were trying to build a health system, they were trying to increase the minimum wage, they were trying to have some agricultural protection for their farmers, and that government was overthrown. Now, that's not a big new story. Government in Latin America being overthrown with the help of the United States is something that happened over and over and over again during the Cold War. Guatemala in the 50s, Brazil, Chile, Argentina, all of these countries experienced overthrows of their, Bolivia, all of these countries had overthrows, they had military coups, they were sponsored by the United States. But 2004 was different because what followed was different. And what followed was an incredibly multilateral kind of arrangement in which there were troops from all over the world. So South Asian countries alone participating in the United Nations mission in Haiti include India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal. all of these countries have troops in Haiti, which is interesting. I don't think many people here know that in this part of the world realize how much of a South Asian footprint there is, how much of an international footprint this part of the world is contributing to. And the economy of Haiti today is controlled through these donor conferences. The donor countries determine Haiti's economic fate and economic future. The administration of services is done by non-governmental organizations. So this, even the paper that's on which, you know, post-World War II we wrote that we would have sovereign countries, there's no respect for that at all in a country like Haiti today. So in a way, Haiti is a model for multilateral control of a country in this world order, and also for the economy being controlled through the control of donation. The Haitian domestic economy is totally broken. It's dependent on remittances. The remittances actually, so Haitians working in America and elsewhere send money home. They send more money home than the donors donate. So this is an important point too. Haitians provide more money to a much bigger contribution to Haiti's GDP than donors do, but donors control the economy. So by contributing a fraction of the aid, the donors are able to set the policy for the entire economy. So it's a bargain. Aid politics is a cheap way to control a very poor country. The next case is Palestine. So Palestine, Israel is occupying the West Bank, the Gaza Strip. This all occurred in the 1940s, right? As the rest of the world was becoming free of colonialism, Israel was coming into existence and annexing territory from this British colony in Palestine. So in the 1990s, again, in the New World Order, there was what was called a peace process that the United States brokered between Israel and the leadership of the Palestinians, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. So aid money, a lot of it from Europe, but also Canada, Japan, other countries, but aid money was used to set up what was called the Palestinian Authority, the PA. So the PA was, the leadership was brought back from North Africa. I don't have time to go into the whole history, I will in my class, but the PA was brought back, the leadership was brought back, aid money was used to set up a governing infrastructure. So the PA was going to administer the West Bank and the Gaza Strip under the ultimate control of Israel. Aid money was also used to ensure the cooperation of Arab countries like Egypt and Jordan in making sure that all of this happened according to what Israel wanted. So in each of these cases, the political consent was won through the use of military aid for Egypt and Jordan and monetary aid to support the establishment of this sub-Israel government of the Palestinian Authority. By setting up this Palestinian Authority with this aid money, they were also able to give the aid money in order to take it away. So in 2006, when the Palestinian Legislative Council had elections and Hamas, the Islamic group, Muslim Brotherhood party in Palestine, when they won, the United States and also Israel and the group of countries supporting the Palestinian Authority, they said, well, sorry, Hamas is a banned organization. We're going to withdraw aid. We're going to withdraw the funding for all of this governance. And we are also going to withdraw it all subject to a series of conditions, political conditions. So Hamas has to renounce violence, Hamas has to agree with agreements, and Hamas has to recognize the state of Israel. So when Hamas refuses to do that, the aid money is taken away. But more than that, so more than just the withdrawal of aid funds, the international donors, the group of countries, again, it's Europe and the U.S. mainly, they also kind of allowed Israel to withhold the tax funding. So part of the PA funds comes from taxes that are levied on Palestinians at borders, duties, whatever, VAT payments, value-added taxes. Israel takes all that, and they're supposed to hand it over to the Palestinian Authority, but they will withhold it for political reasons. They'll say, well, we don't like that you don't recognize us, we don't like this, we don't like that, so we're not going to hand over the money. So again, here, the aid monies, the particular sets of funding, can be used as a tool of political control and political exclusion. The ultimate idea of this withdrawal of funds, the strategic idea, is to say, we won't fund anybody who doesn't agree with our politics. And our politics means recognizing Israel, recognizing Israel's conquests of these territories. So long as you don't do that, we will continue to starve you. And by funding the other countries, the neighboring countries, they also deny the Palestinians a border, right? So the Egyptian border has remained closed. Even after the change of government, there are tunnels, there's a whole tunnel trade, but the Egyptians have recently been flooding those tunnels. There's a lot of details. The point is, here you have a case where aid is used, again, as a means of control and as a means of assisting a neighbor. So the aid to the Palestinians is actually helping Israel in its project of what it's doing to the Palestinians. Now, Afghanistan is a different case. And Afghanistan, again, we'd have to look at the entire history, but if you look at the state of Afghanistan when NATO invaded in 2001, it was a country that had already been completely devastated, right? It had been devastated from the Soviet invasion, from the civil war that followed. All of these wars, by the way, were sponsored externally, right? So the Mujahideen who were fighting the Soviets were sponsored by Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and ultimately the United States. The different Mujahideen, when they started fighting each other, were supported on one hand by Iran, on the other hand by Pakistan. So the regional powers were fighting their war on Afghanistan, physically on the lives and deaths of Afghan people, who were fighting each other in this kind of proxy war for control of this part of the world. So in this completely devastated context, in which the decades of warfare have basically destroyed most possibilities for, you know, political engagement, for a sovereign economy, for a functioning economy, for a functioning infrastructure, you have a foreign power or coalition coming in, and they are coming in with a very specific purpose: to destroy the Taliban. But again, in order to achieve legitimacy, they had to add on increasingly a set of developmental goals. Okay, so we're going to fight the Taliban, but we're also going to liberate women. We're going to lift this depressed economy out of the situation that it's in. But all of these kind of legitimacy-seeking developmental goals were ultimately subordinated to the counterinsurgency. So they invaded and they said, we are doing counterinsurgency, but we are also doing development. But when you try to do counterinsurgency and development, you can't get any development. There's no development that can come out of that, because ultimately it's instrumentalized for warfare. What it ends up doing is delegitimizing any development efforts. So they actually put aid workers in harm's way by doing this. people associate international aid with occupying forces. And they also, of course, I mean, if you look at the budgets, you know, they're spending several billion dollars per month on the military mission and several million dollars per year on the aid mission. So it's, a look at the figures tells you where the priorities are, but even in that context, the developmental agenda is never going to work. All of these cases start with a violation of sovereignty. And I want to just say something about sovereignty, because in my book about Haiti, I'm arguing for a sovereign future. A lot of what I've been doing or advocating is more respect for sovereignty. But sovereignty doesn't just mean that a country can do whatever they want within their borders. Like, I don't think sovereignty means, you know, you can't use an argument for sovereignty to violate human rights, to violate international law, because, and that's why we have an international legal framework, right? That's why legitimacy requires a degree of respect for human rights and for democracy. So the point for me is that sovereignty is not a license for a state to prey on its own population. It's potentially the means for by which a population can exercise their rights, can ensure their rights, especially their economic rights, relative and their economic development in this international context. So, returning to the beginning, an interesting question is, you know, what will India do as it becomes more powerful? In my opinion, Haiti, the case of Haiti especially, suggests to me that these new rising powers have been fairly disappointing if we're hoping for increased sovereignty or democracy or respect for international law from these new powers. Because in Haiti, the whole world is in Haiti, and everybody in the world has colluded in a way to suppress the aspirations of these, you know, this tiny group of poor people. Palestine too, like, you know, all of these rising powers have not been able to do anything or interested in doing anything to support the Palestinians. So, and also these, America is able to create these coalitions of the willing in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. So, you know, when India was not militarily powerful or economically powerful, it was part of the non-aligned movement. And that was, you know, there was this kind of rhetoric about the importance of non-alignment and the importance of, of an independent foreign policy. And you know, the question I think we should ask ourselves is, was that because they didn't have the muscle? Was that because India didn't have the muscle? And now that India will have the muscle, is it going to be based on law of the jungle, we have the muscle, so we determine what happens, or is there going to be some consciousness of sovereignty, of democracy, and of international law? I don't think that this kind of law of the jungle is inevitable, which is why I started off by saying that legitimacy matters. I also think that it's possible for countries to behave internationally on the basis of solidarity. So even in Haiti, you have Cuba and Venezuela that have done international aid. It's international aid by any definition, but they've done so in a way that was trying to build local capacity, that was trying to respect local decision making. So I don't think it's impossible theoretically. I also don't think it's impossible practically. I think there are real examples, but I do think that it's a question for the future, and it's not a foregone conclusion that new powers like India will behave any differently, especially as they take up situations that have been broken by previous imperial interventions. So I'll stop there. And
okay.